wish I was a mole in the ground. If I was a mole in the ground, I'd root that mountain down. And I wish I was a mole in the ground.
Good morning. You are listening to KBOO 90.7 FM, listener-supported community radio. It is time now for the Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm Denise Morris, your host for this December 2nd Monday. Patricia Kohlberg is our engineer. This morning on the Old Mole, Bill Resnick interviews Lynn Adelman, a federal judge in Wisconsin. They discuss his latest article, The Roberts Court: Assault on Democracy. That's part one of a two-part interview. Well, Red Red is Fran Michelle this morning, and she continues digesting the meaning of the USA's harvest holiday. Bill Resnick returns to talk in studio with Sandy Palmiter about Chase Bank defunding Jordan Cove and building a movement with a just transition as an end to climate crisis. Susan Palmiter is an environmental activist with 350PDX, Divest Reinvestment Team. Book Mole Larry Bolden reviews Carrie Ann King's novel, Everything You Are. It's a novel about a cello with a soul and the humans that are fated to love and protect it. And to close the show this morning from the archives, Joe Clement and special guest Dennis Gravy review the classic Christmas time cartoon, A Charlie Brown Christmas. Originally aired in 2015, they consider anti-commercialism, alienation, cultural appropriation, white supremacy, and why the workers' revolution that seems to promise an answer to Charlie Brown's problems falls flat. That's a perfect way to, I think, enter into the holiday madness that's about to come on us. But here we go. It's the Old Mole. I'm Denise Morris. Thanks for tuning in this morning, and thanks to KBOO members old and new for supporting community radio. I'll let you know a little bit more about your opportunities to support KBOO later in the program. Remember, you can find us on the web on KBOO's website, kboo.fm/Old Mole Variety Hour. And now, Bill Resnick and Lynn Adelman.
Lynn Adelman, welcome to KBOO. Lynn Adelman is a federal judge in the Eastern District of Wisconsin. He's always been a fighting liberal, supporting economic, social, and civil rights for all, one of the last liberal judges appointed in the Clinton administration. He writes articles not on technical issues of the law, rather he writes on politics and the court and the importance of court decisions on the politics and daily life, particularly of working people. All of his work is completely accessible, some in law reviews, others in generally left or sort of literary journals. His latest article is an evaluation of the Roberts Court. It's titled, courageously, The Roberts Court Assault on Democracy. Roberts is, of course, the Chief Justice of today's U.S. Supreme Court. The article will be published in the Harvard Review of Law and Policy in the next several months, and it avoids, again, technical language, and it's perfectly accessible to popular audiences. In the article, Judge Adelman contends that today's court, the Roberts Court, is built on the conservative values and jurisprudence of the Berger and Rehnquist courts before him, all three moving to undermine the gains made by working people through the New Deal, the 30s and 40s and mid-century America, and also the civil rights movement, that these gains were democratizing, and that conservative courts since the 70s have reversed this trend and instead, in case after case after case, have weakened the capacity of working people to organize and be heard, and at the same time increased the power of the rich and corporations. So, Judge Adelman, let's go through the Roberts Court assault on democracy, starting with voting rights and then getting into how decisions by the Roberts Court and some before them, the conservative courts, increased inequality, strengthened corporate power, and weakened working class power to organize and participate and have their voice heard.
Well, I wanted to write about the Roberts Court generally and what it's doing with respect to important issues of equality and democracy. And I think a particularly glaring example of some real decisions that are not at all helpful to democracy. In fact, you could argue really subvert it, are its decisions in the voting rights area. And I mean, I think when we start talking about voting rights and the court, the Roberts Court, I think that probably the best place to start is with the decisions regarding the Voting Rights Act. Now, the Voting Rights Act was passed by Congress in 1965. Basically, the idea was to protect minority voting rights. And in a sense, it was an effort to keep a promise made 100 years earlier in the 15th Amendment. The idea there was, after the Civil War, three important amendments were adopted. The 13th, which dealt with slavery, the 14th, which basically dealt with equal protection and due process, and then the 15th, which dealt with voting rights. And those amendments, for a variety of complicated reasons, were never enforced to the extent that I think that the Reconstruction Congress, which passed them, intended them to be. And so the Voting Rights Act in 1965 was sort of an effort to, I guess, belatedly keep the promise of the 15th Amendment. And the idea was to protect minority voting rights. It was a landmark statute. Many people thought it was the most important and effective civil rights law ever passed in this country. And basically, the court's decisions have really undermined it a great deal, the Roberts Court's decisions. I think the first one to be talking about is the Shelby County case, Shelby County versus Holder. It basically was an effort to renew the Voting Rights Act. And Congress had done a great deal of research and compiled an extensive legislative history and evidence of the need to reinstate or to continue the Voting Rights Act, and particularly the part of the Voting Rights Act known as preclearance. And what that preclearance statute did was basically, it said that certain states and certain municipalities which had had histories of not protecting minority voting rights and in fact undermining minority rights had to get permission either from the Attorney General or from a three-judge court before they could make any changes in their voting laws. The idea was to actually provide some additional protection for minorities in areas which had histories of not being very concerned about minority voting rights. The case went to the U.S. Supreme Court, and basically the Supreme Court, in an opinion written by the Chief Justice, and again it was, I believe, a 5-4 decision, where most of these decisions are 5-4, and it basically struck down the reinstatement of, I think it's Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act, which dealt with this preclearance. And basically what the majority said was that times had changed, and these protections weren't necessary anymore. And voting discrimination was a thing of the past, and we really didn't need this kind of, overseeing of certain states and localities. And, you know, the effect of this was, I mean, the very day that the Supreme Court announced its decision, I think some states, Texas, I think, put into effect a voter ID statute. Other municipalities and states reinstated laws that would never have been allowed under the preclearance provisions. And so basically, though, the Supreme Court in their decision just ignored all the evidence that Congress had compiled. So it was a very sort of activist kind of decision, and it had a very negative impact. Another case dealing with the Voting Rights Act was a case known as Abbott. And what it did was it dealt with racial gerrymandering in Texas by the state legislature. And a three-judge bench in Texas, three federal judges, and I know that they were appointed by different presidents of different political parties, and basically they compiled a very extensive record, taking testimony. I think that evidence took years, And they decided that there was a racial gerrymander by the Texas legislature in constructing the legislative districts in Texas, and they struck it down. And then that case also went to the Supreme Court, and once again in a 5-4 decision, the Roberts Court ignored all the evidence that had been compiled by the 3-judge bench and basically made some law suggesting that there was there should be a presumption that legislatures act in good faith on these issues. The upshot of the Abbott versus Perez, I think was the name of it, is that it's going to be very difficult for plaintiffs to establish racial gerrymandering in the future. So this is another case that really undermined the whole point of the Voting Rights Act, which was to make sure that minority voting rights were protected.
Yeah, there was also, they've supported the purges, right? Basically, the Supreme Court is just in ridiculous decisions, actually. It's amazing how they find sort of facts out of the air and assume they're somehow true, like in the purges in Ohio, for example. There was a challenge to purging Ohio voters who hadn't voted in the last election. Ohio is just trying to get rid of black voters in Cleveland and northern Ohio, and working class voters, too, are areas where they concentrate Democratic voters. Tell us a little bit about the purges.
Well, the key case on that was a 2018 decision. The case was called Husted versus A. Philip Randolph Institute. This is another 5-4 decision. And what it did is it involved Ohio, more than any other state, does these massive voter purges. The alleged idea is to have people who are not eligible to vote taken off the voting rolls. What Ohio does is if a voter doesn't vote regularly, they use that as evidence that the voter has moved and thus should be eliminated from the voting list. There's a national statute on this, again passed in the 60s, I believe, National Voter Registration Act, and that bars any state from removing a registrant by reason of the person's failure to vote. Basically, the law recognizes that some people don't vote that often, and maybe they only vote in elections where they're very interested, but there's no reason that they should be prevented from voting because they don't vote often. But according to the court, Ohio's purge passed muster because it was not triggered by a failure to vote, said the court, but it was merely used as evidence that the person had moved. And the effect of this also was, I think, in some of the big cities where there's large African-American population in Ohio, Cleveland, and I believe Akron, Cincinnati, Columbus, many, many African-Americans were struck from the voting rolls. And again, it undermines people's right to vote, which is the basic fundamental. If there's anything more fundamental to democracy than the right to vote, I'm not sure what it is.
Yeah, this is KABU Radio, 90.7 FM, Portland, Oregon. Bill Resnick here for the Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm talking to Judge Lynn Edelman of the Eastern District of Wisconsin. He wrote the article, The Roberts Court Assault on Democracy, to be published in the Harvard Journal on Law and Policy soon. We discussed how the John Roberts-led Supreme Court has eviscerated the U.S. Voting Rights Act. Again, that was part one. Next week, or perhaps later in December, we will play part two on the Roberts Court decisions, those that supported corporate power and enriched the rich while undermining the power and prospects of the great majority. So stay tuned to the Old Mole every Monday at 9 on KABU, telling truth to power.
Order in the court!
Thank you, thank you. I want no shenanigans in my courtroom. Please bring on the first case.
That is Judge is Funky. That's the Jay Giles Band version. Believe it or not, there's another version of that song. Later in the program, we will hear from book mole Larry Bolden, who's reviewing Carrie Ann King's novel, Everything You Are. And we'll conclude with Joe Clement and Dennis Gravy reviewing the classic Christmas time cartoon, A Charlie Brown Christmas. Yes, from a mole perspective. Next up, we have well-read Red Fran Michelle. She continues digesting the meaning of the USA's harvest holiday.
Much of the United States is still full of it, full of turkey and stuffing and yams, full of pumpkin pie and full of lies about the past and about the present. In his book, This Land Is Their Land, The Wampanoag Indians, Plymouth Colony, and the Troubled History of Thanksgiving, historian David Silverman summarizes the myth in which friendly Indians, unidentified by tribe, welcome the pilgrims to America, teach them how to live in this new place, sit down to dinner with them, and then disappear. They hand off America to white people so they can create a great nation dedicated to liberty, opportunity, and Christianity for the rest of the world to profit. That's the story. It's about native people conceding to colonialism. This story omits the history of at least 12,000 years of indigenous life on this continent and about 100 years of colonialism in New England before that 1621 feast. The Wampanoags, or at least some of them, led by Usamekin, often called by his title Massasoit, were interested in allying with the English at Plymouth not out of noble friendliness, but because the tribe had already been decimated by disease brought by the European arrivals, and wanted allies in maintaining their territory against their traditional rivals, the Narragansetts, who had escaped the epidemic. It also omits what came later, including the continued seizure of native lands. Philip DeLoria, writing in The New Yorker, summarizes the ways the English repaid their new allies. The settlers pressed hard to acquire Indian land through sales driven by debt, threat, alliance politics, and violence. They denied the coequal civil and criminal jurisdiction of the alliance, charging Indians under English law and sentencing them to unpayable fines, imprisonment, even executions. In 1637, the governor of the Massachusetts Bay Colony declared a day of thanksgiving to celebrate the massacre of 700 men, women, and children of the Pequot tribe, after which survivors were enslaved and some of them sent to the Caribbean. This sort of treatment led the natives to realize that, as Silverman puts it, if they didn't rise up immediately, they were going to become, at best, landless subordinates to English authority. Native groups joined together in what became known as King Philip's War. As DeLoria tells it, in 1675 and 1676, native soldiers attacked 52 towns in New England, destroyed 17 of them, and killed a substantial portion of the settler population. The region also lost as much as 40% of its native population, who fought on both sides. The war split Wampanoags, as well as every other native group, and ended with indigenous resistance broken, and the colonists giving thanks. Part of the Plymouth celebration included mounting the head of Osamakin's son, Dometcom, above their town on a pike, where it remained for 2 decades. DeLoria points out that, like most colonial wars, this one was a giant slave expedition, marked by the seizure and sale of Indian people. Wampanoags were judged criminals and, in a foreshadowing of the convict labor provision of the 13th Amendment, sold into bondage. During the next 2 centuries, New England Indians also suffered indentured servitude, convict labor, and debt peonage, which often resulted in the enslavement of the debtor's children. The less brutal holiday that we celebrate today took shape 2 centuries later as an effort to entrench an imagined American community. In 1841, the Reverend Alexander Young explicitly linked 3 things, the 1621 rejoicing, the tradition of autumnal harvest festivals, and the name Thanksgiving. A couple of decades later, Sarah Josepha Hale, the editor of Godey's Lady Book, proposed a day of unity and remembrance to counter the trauma of the Civil War. And in 1863, Abraham Lincoln declared the last Thursday of November to be that national holiday, following Young's lead and calling it Thanksgiving. As Silverman argues, the myth and the holiday gained purchase in the late 19th century when there was an enormous amount of anxiety and agitation over immigration. The white Protestant stock of the United States was widely unhappy about the influx of European Catholics and Jews and wanted to assert its cultural authority over these newcomers. How better to do that than to create this national founding myth around the pilgrims and the Indians, inviting them to take over the land? This myth-making was also impacted by the racial politics of the late 19th century. The Indian Wars were coming to a close, and that was an opportune time to have Indians included in a national founding myth. You couldn't have done that when people were reading newspaper accounts on a regular basis of atrocious violence between white Americans and Native people in the West. What's more, during Reconstruction, the Thanksgiving myth allowed New Englanders to create this idea that bloodless colonialism in their region was the origin of the country, having nothing to do with the Indian Wars and slavery. In 1970, Wampanoag leader Wamsutta Frank James was invited to give a speech at a banquet celebrating the 350th anniversary of the landing of the Pilgrims, and planned to include the Pequot Massacre and the story of King Philip's War in his remarks. But after reading a draft of his talking points, the dinner's organizers decided to cancel the speech, which prompted James to start the National Day of Mourning. Perhaps ironically, the annual Day of Mourning takes place on Coles Hill in Plymouth, site of a statue of Massasoit. Such statues proliferated in the early 20th century, much as Confederate monuments did, and for similar reasons. Lisa Blee and Jean O'Brien suggest in their book, Monumental Mobility, The Memory Work of Massasoit, that the Massasoit statue links the mythic memory of the 1621 feast with the racial, ethnic, and national identity politics of 1921, when the original statue was commissioned. The legend of the generous Indians and the harmonious feast with the Pilgrims provides a tale of white Protestant founders to divert attention from early 20th century immigration and Jim Crow violence. These conflicts are, of course, not just historical. In September 2018, the Department of Interior decided to take land held in trust for the Mashpee Wampanoag Nation out of trust, effectively dissolving the reservation. A bill to restore tribal land and sovereignty passed the House earlier this year, but stalled in the Senate. Organizers of the National Day of Mourning also used the occasion to organize politically, this year working for bills in the Massachusetts legislature, making a statewide Indigenous Peoples Day, prohibiting the use of Native sports teams' names and mascots, redesigning the state flag and seal, supporting Native education, and protecting Native heritage. Participants at the National Day of Mourning also spoke about the crisis of missing and murdered Indigenous women, as well as government crackdowns on mostly Indigenous migrants from Latin America and the detentions of children. People from tribes in New York, Louisiana, Canada, and Mexico spoke out against pipelines, dams, and hydropower stations. Broader still is the vision of the Red Nation and the Red Deal. Red Nation was formed in 2014 to address the marginalization and invisibility of Indigenous struggles within mainstream social justice organizing, and to speak out and strategically fight against the ongoing destruction of Indigenous life and land. The Red Deal is, as they put it, one part visionary platform, one part practical toolkit, aiming to build movements that can halt climate change and prioritize Indigenous liberation. The Red Deal emphasizes grassroots movement building and draws from people power to enact reform. It's time, they say, to reclaim the life and destiny that has been stolen from us and rise up together to confront this challenge and build a world where all life can thrive. Check out their plan at theRedNation.org. It's something to be thankful for. For the Old Mole, this has been Fran Michel.
You are listening to KBOO 90.7. This is FM radio, listener supported, and it's the Old Mole Variety Hour. I am Denise Morris, and thanks to Patricia there in the engineering booth for keeping us going this morning. It's time to talk about defunding Jordan Cove, and we're pretty excited about that. We have Susan Palmiter in studio, and Bill Resnick is joining us from my home state, California. Bill, do we have you?
I am here in California. It's a beautiful sunny day. Thank you, Denise. Not new to KBOO listeners, this is an age of human-caused climate change, particularly global warming. A major cause, of course, is the burning of fossil fuels, coal, oil, and natural gas. That burning produces the gas carbon dioxide. It forms a blanket that traps the heat of the sun. Less of the heat is reflected back into space, and the planet heats up and heats up and heats up. As a result, we, humanity, must very soon replace fossil fuels with sun and wind energy, that to avoid global roasting and possible human extinction. So one of the folks working hard to save us all, Susan Palmiter, welcome to KABU.
Thank you. Appreciate your introduction, and I'm really happy to be here to speak about this.
Susan Palmiter is a tech researcher. She dabbles in design, also an environmental activist working with 350.org on their Divest Invest team on a campaign that forces the largest funder of fossil fuel companies around the world. That funder is the J.P. Morgan Chase Company. The Divest Investment campaign is demanding that the Chase Bank stop all lending to fossil fuel companies by 2030. And also demanding that Chase immediately defund the Jordan Cove natural gas pipeline project that ends in beautiful Coos Bay, Oregon. So, Susan, tell us about 350.org, why you joined, why you're going after J.P. Morgan Chase, those poor little fellows, and why you were seeking to stop the Jordan Cove project.
Great. Lots of questions there. I'd be happy to talk about all of them. 350 is an organization that's been around for about 10 years nationally, and in Portland about 7 years. Many of your listeners, I'm sure, are familiar with them. They are the many environmental activist groups in the city and in the state. I first became aware of them, you know, I've heard about them, but I saw a movie called Reluctant Radical with Ken Ward, and I recommend you watch it on Netflix if you haven't seen it, but it's about a local activist who was one of the pipe turners and was arrested hoping to use the necessity defense to bring attention to the climate crisis that we're in. At that meeting, the 350 folks were there, and they were talking about the Portland Clean Energy Fund and asking folks to gather signatures. So that was my first foray with them. But, you know, I've really been kind of in the background thinking the government or our technologists, being a technologist, that they would save us. And it's quite clear we are past that point. The name of 350 means 350 parts per million of carbon dioxide in our atmosphere, and we're already at 407. So we are past a tipping point already. And the time is now. The house is on fire. So in the last year, I've really been thinking about where to spend my energy and my time, and deciding I don't want to live in fear anymore. We are in a climate crisis. It's not a climate change. We are in a crisis. And so acknowledging that despair, rolling up my sleeves, deciding that I needed to do something, I got involved with the climate strike in September and was so impressed with how 350 and the organizers there, Chris Palmer, Deneen O'Rourke, Sarah, some other folks, came together and really centered the youth's voices. It's really their strike, and 350 just really wrapped around them and held an amazing strike, one of the largest in the country per capita. We're not the largest city, so that's pretty cool. So saw how they really brought the community together there, not just a rally, not just a march, but also this huge festival with information and workshops and art, and it was just an incredible day. So moving on from there, I've gotten involved with the campaign around the J.P. Morgan Chase, which you led with. And for me, that seems to be where the energy needs to be. We need to follow that money. That's been where success has been in the past. And I think we need to follow how these organizations, these companies are being funded, the fossil fuel companies. 350PDX has worked in the past on divestment and looking at our institutions, our government institutions, the city, the county, universities, and our philanthropic organizations. And they've done a good job of getting our city and county to divest from fossil fuels. The next round out is really looking at banks, insurance companies, and asset managers. And as you mentioned in your intro, J.P. Morgan Chase is the largest funder of fossil fuels in the world. North American banks are the top, but J.P. Morgan Chase in the last 3 years has funded $196 billion of fossil fuel infrastructure, and especially the new types of projects that are the most damaging, underwater exploration and the fracking and so forth. And so they're really the dirtiest. There's an amazing article by Bill McKibben, who started 350 about 10 years ago, in the New Yorker that I recommend everyone read, and it's called Money is the Oxygen on Which the Fire of Global Warming Burns. And in that article, he talks about banks and insurance companies and asset managers being where we need to focus our attention. So that's where we get to now.
Right. And if you go at Chase, my understanding is if you go at Chase, which is the largest and the leader, all the others will have to will follow for a variety of reasons that you can explain. Now, tell us about that.
Right. So
and that fossil fuel companies will be forced to go to much more expensive borrowers if they can get any money at all. And a few of them have gone bankrupt in the coal industry recently, partly because of the refusal of banks to give them any more money. So tell us about that.
Right. There have been successes. So when 350 started their divestment work 7 years ago or so, Peabody Energy, the largest American coal company at the time, filed for bankruptcy in 2016, and it cited divestment as one of the pressures on its business. And then this year, Shell called divestment a material adverse effect on its performance. So clearly divestment has been working on the coal industry, and the coal industry is a little bit easier just because it's pretty dirty and there are other forces at work. They're having trouble getting insurance and so forth because of other forces. So but that campaign did bring home the fact that the industry is starting to really feel pressures in many ways. And so one, you know, for example, Pope Francis, you know, summoned the industry executives to the Vatican to say they have to leave their carbon underground. So more and more forces are coming to bear there. And we're seeing that with the insurance companies too. There's an organization based out of Australia called Sunrise Project, and they have worked on insurance companies, and they've gotten several European insurance companies to produce a policy saying they won't insure, or they won't. And insurance companies are big investors as well, and they're putting policies in place to not invest, specifically starting with coal. But there have been successes in that way. And the reason that Bill McKibben points out J.P. Morgan Chase is the one to go after is, yes, there are 10 huge banks worldwide, mostly in North America, Bank of America, Wells Fargo, and so forth. But J.P. Morgan Chase is the biggest. And if the other banks see J.P. Morgan Chase start defunding fossil fuel infrastructure and projects, the others will follow suit. So that's why we're really going after J.P. Morgan
Chase. Right. Yeah, I hope they don't put the money into some other projects that are not equally terrible, but also terrible. That's another question. Susan Palmiter, we're running out of time, actually. You've been great. Let's skip the part about the other part. There's a lot of struggles going on at federal and state levels. You, for example, went to Salem and tried to get Governor Brown and the legislature and the regulatory agencies to step in and stop Jordan Cove, which they, in fact, are trying to do at some level with a lawsuit. We also have the PCEF, the Portland Clean Energy Fund. Here is another important initiative in Oregon. I think, though, we're going to have to talk about what can be done now, in not only in stopping Chase, but also expanding the Portland Clean Energy Fund by about 10,000% so that we can really build out clean energy.
Right.
Tell us what can be done and what 350.org, for example, is doing.
Our campaign right now is called Cut the Chase Challenge, and we're asking everyone to look in their wallets. They probably have a Chase card that they don't even realize is a Chase card. Southwest Airlines, United, Starbucks, Amazon, all of those are Chase cards. And what we've asked is everyone gets that Chase card out, talks to their friends and family, and cut that card up, because every time you swipe, it is funding fossil fuel infrastructure and new projects. And so there's more information on the 350 PDX website in our campaigns drop down. You'll find something about the Cut the Chase Challenge, and specifically in Oregon, that is to defund the Jordan Cove pipeline. Makes no sense. So cutting that Chase connection and doing it any way you can, talking to friends and family, making sure that they don't use Chase as well, is where we're headed.
And you're headed in many other directions too. Check out the environmental movement in Portland. 350.org is one of the leading forces. Susan Palmiter, thanks so much for talking to us today, and keep doing all that good work.
Thanks. I've got a lot of other folks with me, Taryn and Sandy and Caitlin, that are working volunteers with me as well. And I thank you for the time you've given me today to talk about this important issue.
Right. So long.
Take care.
Talk to you again.
Thank you, Bill and Susan.
We're going to conclude our show later with a review, speaking of consumerism, that is, with Joe Clement and Dennis Gravy talking about the Charlie Brown Christmas and considering anti-consumerism, alienation, and the like. But here now we have book mole Larry Bolden reviewing Carrie Ann King's novel, Everything You Are.
Good morning. I want to talk to you this morning about a delightful book by a luthier, that is, a maker of violins and other stringed instruments, his granddaughter, and a cello with a soul. When Braden Healy's mother takes him to a violin shop to buy him a violin, a cello across the room beckons him, speaks to him, and so begins a love affair that will last a lifetime. Ophelia McPhee, Fee for short, is 18 years old and has been working in her grandfather's shop, McPhee's Fine Instruments, for many years, when he calls her to his apartment to give her a birthday present. She expects perhaps her grandmother's emerald ring, or something related to the luthier business. Instead, her grandfather tells her he is giving her the business. With his attorney present as a witness, he induces Fee to sign a contract saying he will take over the business. Quote, I, Ophelia Florence McPhee, being of sound mind and purpose, do hereby swear a sacred oath to accept and discharge all obligations, tangible and intangible, related to the post of luthier. Close quote. Although uneasy about signing and wondering about the intangible obligations, she signs the document. Her grandfather explains he's dying of cancer, and that has necessitated the rush to have her sign. The eccentric grandfather has, of course, sold many instruments over the years, and in a few cases has insisted the purchaser enter into an agreement to play the instrument until his or her death, and then the instrument is to be returned to the luthier. Quoting again from the book, a forever home, you understand, a marriage. This cello is not a thing to be acquired and cast aside, and when you die and the bond is broken, your next of kin will bring the cello back to me, here. Close quote. Braden Healy is only 12 when he enters into his bond, and while the luthier thinks him a bit young to enter such a bond, he remarks only that the cello has spoken. She is the boss of us, yes, not the other way. If the bond is broken, there will be dire consequences, and so the scene is set. Fee must keep her oath concerning this cello and a handful of other instruments sold under similar contracts. Unfortunately, many years later, when Brandon is a successful cellist with a seat on the Seattle Symphony, his hands are severely frostbitten as he attempts to save his brother-in-law, who has fallen through a hole in the ice while ice fishing. When Braden can no longer play the cello, he sinks into depression and into alcoholism. On several occasions, Fee meets with Braden to exhort him to return to playing the cello. He laughs ruefully, displaying his hands, which he can use for day-to-day things, but which can no longer feel the strings of the cello. The author is thinking of her character, Braden, and others, when she opens her novel with this quote from Nietzsche, "Without music, life would be a mistake." Adding to the tragic of Braden, his wife and son are killed in a car accident, and he returns to his home to try to salvage a relationship with his 17-year-old daughter. She's also a cellist, but gives it up after her mother and brother die. While both she and her father hear cello chords echoing in their lonely house, neither plays the cello anymore as it languishes in its corner. It's every bit as important as a character in this novel as the others I have mentioned. Author King manages to convince me that the cello does have a soul, its voice rising and falling as the events in the novel occur. The granddaughter Fee was there the day that Braden signed the contract, entered into the oath, and when he returns home, she is diligent in her attempts to get Braden to honor his contract. She believes in the curse her grandfather's put on Braden, and slowly Fee falls in love with this boy become man, and their relationship adds a sweetness to the story, as does a budding relationship between Allie, Braden's daughter, and Ethan, a boy who dates wild girls and rides a motorcycle. Quoting again from the book about this relationship, stars and boys like Ethan are great at a distance. Too close and they'll burn your wings and dump you into the sea. A lesson she learned both from the story of Icarus and watching the dramas of other girls who dared to fly too close to the sun. Close quote. In addition to really interesting talk about music and fine instruments, this is a compelling story. I played Bach's marvelous cello suites as I read it, and soon, like Braden and Allie and Fee, I began to hear cello chords throughout the day. Braden refuses to talk about the particulars of his brother-in-law's death in the frozen lake, and this mystery adds one more layer to a really captivating tale. Will Braden play again, and what will be the dire consequences if he does not? These and other questions await your reading of this splendid novel. I've been talking about Carrie Ann King's 2019 novel, Everything You Are. This is Larry Bolden for the Old Mole Variety Hour.
And thank you, Larry. All right, we're going to conclude the show this morning with Joe Clement and Dennis Gravy from the archives. 2015, they reviewed the classic Christmas time cartoon, A Charlie Brown Christmas. And they talk about anti-consumerism, alienation, cultural appropriation, white supremacy, and the workers' revolution. And yes, it's all in The Charlie Brown Christmas.
In 1965, Charles Schulz's comic strip Peanuts, which had already been in newspapers for 15 years, appeared on National Network Television in the form of A Charlie Brown Christmas. A mere 25 minutes long, not counting commercials, the story starts with Charlie expressing his signature anxiety and depression around the coming Christmas season. He says he's not happy like he feels he's supposed to, or sees in his peers, and that despite getting gifts and material things and doing family Christmas rituals that he likes, he's still unhappy. As new main characters are introduced, they display some sort of grating affirmation of what Charlie Brown deplores as commercialism. The character Lucy suggests that Charlie Brown get involved to combat his alienation, specifically in directing a school Christmas play. When he shows up, no one seems to take him very seriously, and it's eventually decided the play needs a Christmas tree. Charlie goes out to buy one, but can only find a limp sapling of a tree. This leads to more ridicule. Charlie Brown tries to decorate the tree, but gives up and walks off. In the next and final scene, the whole cast appears and collectively transforms the tree, almost by magic, into a spectacle of its former self. Charlie Brown returns, elated, and they sing, and the movie ends. Well, I am joined today by a special guest to help review this classic American movie, A Charlie Brown Christmas. We have Dennis Gravy on, a member of the Industrial Workers of the World and the Maryland Buck Abolitionist Collective. Thanks for coming on to the Old Mole today, Dennis.
Yeah, glad to be here.
So, Dennis, you had emailed me about this because we know each other and said, hey, I really like this movie. It's an all-time American classic and has some interesting things going on in it that I think we could talk about on the Old Mole about American society and just kind of the ongoing struggle for liberation. So why did you want to talk about this?
Well, I always liked the movie. I grew up with it. I watched it as a kid, but I wasn't necessarily my nostalgia that I keep on watching it every year. I really just like the tone. I think it's a really aesthetically beautiful and almost poetic piece. But now watching it again with a political lens and trying to make a review of it, I think it opens up some really fascinating conversations.
Yeah, I mean, the film's explicit like message or kind of plot concern has to do with what in the movie is referred to as commercialism, which for different viewers has resonated as kind of a euphemism for capitalism. I do think that this is a bit different than consumerism, but maybe we can try to address that later. You think this film resonates with American culture in a way that allows us to talk about race. What does race have to do with this film?
Yeah, well, I don't think it directly talks about any of that, but given its own narrative and its own place in American history, like just situating it in time, I think it offers some really interesting opportunities to open those conversations. So my sense of the movie is that it's sort of this narrative of Charlie Brown trying to find authenticity. Right, he's recognizing a kind of alienation and a kind of inauthenticity in the everyday life within American capitalism. I think we have to be very clear that the commercialism that he's decrying is a product of commodified labor and a commodity society. So He goes through various stages of trying to get involved. He starts with this massive depression, which he continues the rest of the time, which is an indication of a kind of realism, right? He can't hold up this lie. And he's trying to find ways to get his grip on the world. The suggestion of Lucy to go get involved, quote unquote, is a first brush to become a boss, right? That's his first attempt to find authenticity, is to find some command ownership over other people's work in the form of being a director. And that fails mostly because he doesn't have any legitimate authority. His workers don't respect him, and he doesn't have a way to actually bridge that gap within the situation. And so he leaves and he says, we're going to get a tree. And he goes and he sees, okay, so this is not what I wanted. I don't want these big aluminum trees. I want something authentic. And he does the next stage, which is embracing the marginal, right? He goes and finds the weak and the feeble and the meek, and he embraces and says, this is authenticity, right? It's something that is forgotten and lost and no one cares about. Brings his tree back. And then he gets decried, right? People don't care about this. And in some ways he sees this wasn't an answer, right? So what's the next stage? The next stage is when he says, doesn't anybody know what Christmas really means? And Linus gets in and says, I know what Christmas means, and recites the Bible, the true biblical definition of Christmas. And I think there's an important moment there. I always grew up loving that moment because of its stillness, and biblical language is actually very beautiful. But there's a way that it falls flat. And watching it, especially again as an adult, after Linus does his recitation, there's a quiet, and the only thing that Charlie Brown can do is walk away. Because it doesn't work. It's not enough. It doesn't fix the tree. It doesn't fix how he feels. It's almost like a dictionary definition of what Christmas means. And he goes off, and he attempts one last time. His last stage is his own personal capacity. He says, I'm going to fix this tree. And he goes, and after his final betrayal of his faithful companion dog, but he takes the ornament off of Snoopy's house, puts it on the tree, and it's destroyed. And he has this one beautifully depressed, beautifully self-brutal line.
Everything I touch gets ruined.
And then he wanders away. And then there's a final moment of redemption that I think is, to some extent, can we understand as a moral of the story, or we could understand as a moral of the story, where his workers, right? In this context, they were his employees. They come to the tree and they have some sympathy for it. They find collectively some sympathy. And what do? They do this magic that you talked about. And the magic is their collective labor. They sort of mass into this spinning ball of hands, and they take all the decorations off the doghouse and wave themselves on the tree, and the tree becomes magically transformed into a beautiful icon of authenticity. And Charlie Brown comes back, and he is embraced by them in a joyous cry of Merry Christmas, and then they sing in a sort of beloved community sort of feeling. And I think that to me is maybe against the grain, but a hopeful narrative reading of the piece as it stands, founded in the idea of collective labor as a form of solidarity.
It's a film that casts all white characters. There isn't an African-American character in Charles Schulz comics until he creates Franklin in 1968, 3 years after Charlie Brown Christmas. And it's telling a story about capitalism and the way in which it impinges on Christmas, which I think is coded for American culture as like white culture. Obviously, African Americans and people of other races and ethnicities have taken on the Christian religion, but in America, it is tied, I think, most heavily to white identity. And so it is the natural go-to for the dominant society's idea of how capitalism is undermining its roots, while not really allowing for any reflection on how its roots are part of its own malaise. And so that's why it focuses on Christianity, but it doesn't leave too many windows for seeing a broader kind of multicultural, multi-ethnic, full American society that is also grappling with quote-unquote commercialism, and how that doesn't just take away the good feeling of the season, but actually makes life objectively miserable.
And I think that we should stick for a second on whether this final moment of authenticity is actually viable, is actually legitimate, because I think reflecting on it, it doesn't really work. Right, I think not only because we have this implied blind spot of anyone else who doesn't look like the people on the screen, but we also have just the fact that there's been no transformation of everyday life. there's just been a collective embrace for a brief moment. And Charlie Brown's depression isn't over. The rest of Charlie Brown continues to happen, and he's a very depressed child for the rest of the Peanuts universe. And so there is a way in which that kind of solidarity that I think the movie does profess fails, and fails miserably in its job.
When they go searching for the tree in the end, they're going through the tree lot, which in the 1960s could very well be populated by aluminum trees in addition to just regular cut farm trees. And when they find the little underdog tree, which, you know, has a lot of appeal because of the underdog narrative in American culture and maybe across cultures, they take it back, and, you know, it's not physically able of supporting the traditional ornaments. I mean, all that Charlie Brown puts on it is a bulb, which doesn't weigh anything, and it still pulls it over. It emphasizes the, like, burden of what that spectacle is for this little, albeit authentic, tree. And when the cast of the play dress it up, they pull all of the inauthentic decorations off of Snoopy's house, which just won first prize for the decoration contest, and they use it as the material to transform the tree into something that just doesn't look like the tree that we saw, which only had like four or five branches. It's now this full conical shaped, green, beautiful, covered with bulbs and ribbons, like I said, spectacle of its former self. And in a way, that's satisfying, and it's supposed to represent the satisfaction they're after. And yet, I think if we pay attention to where they just were, we realize that it takes its cues for that satisfaction from the very culture that is leaving it dissatisfied.
Yeah, and I think that part of why I brought up the aesthetic that I like about it, that aesthetic feels very authentic and feels very profound, but I agree that the kind of cosmology that it still operates with is a commodified cosmology. This movie was actually funded by Coca-Cola, right? And Coca-Cola is one of the originary American producers of Christmas as a commodity. So the exact thing that Charlie Brown is decrying is the thing that makes this whole movie possible. And adding on this level of authenticity to what is ultimately, objectively, an inauthentic life world.
So let's talk about race again.
Thinking about race offers a really important opportunity to problematize that moral that I mentioned that I brought out of this, and I think give some deep lessons for what a workers' revolution means and how it could be possible. So the end of this movie to me is not satisfying. Just let's be real. Charlie Brown is not going to stop being depressed after this movie. Charlie Brown's friends are not going to stop being really mean to him after this movie. And the commodified culture is not going to go away as a constituent of the everyday life as part of this movie.
And the Charlie Brown franchise depends on that.
Absolutely, absolutely. And the question then is, what is holding together that everyday life for those kids that this moment of solidarity, embrace of labor doesn't do, right? And to me, we can look at it by thinking about jazz. And thinking about cool, right? Because what allows the other kids to get through the day that Charlie Brown can't access? It's dancing to jazz, right? When they're doing the play and they start dancing, Lucy goes, "Isn't this great?" And Charlie Brown goes, "No, this is terrible. This is not Christmas." In the end, then, white society and white solidarity, the solidarity of white labor that I think this movie has a moral of, is founded on the domination of the black subject, is founded on white supremacy. And it's that foundation that holds it back from actually achieving any revolutionary transformation of society. We have a vision in this movie of a Norman Rockwell solidarity of labor that is also a solidarity with imperialism. So this is one thing then that it would take to have this labor solidarity mean actual transformation and abolition of commodity society. It would mean radically abolishing white supremacy and the liberation of the black subject.
Yeah, in a way, we're not saying that that's what should be in the film itself, per se, as far as its story, but because those are the conditions of the American society and culture that have produced this or helped to produce this comic, those conditions limit the possibility of its own vision achieving what it promises to, which is, you know, being happy with doing stuff together again.
Totally.
Well, that is all the time that we have for this review of A Charlie Brown Christmas. I would like to thank Dennis Gravy of the Industrial Workers of the World and the Marilyn Buck Abolitionist Collective for coming on.
Thanks so much, yeah.
I'm Jill Clement.
Well, this is KBOO, Portland. This is listener-supported community radio. And that was Joe Clement and Dennis Gravy with a review of Charlie Brown Christmas. And inspired by this insightful review of Charlie Brown, I will join Joe Clement on December 23rd for a review of another Christmas classic, the Rankin and Bass stop-motion short Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer, think Misfits and Bumbles, that will be on December 23rd. KBOO is an independent, member-supported, non-commercial, volunteer-powered community radio station, and tomorrow, December 3rd, is Giving Tuesday, celebrated the Tuesday following Thanksgiving and created as a contrast to the consumerism of Black Friday and Cyber Monday. This year, Giving Tuesday is also the first day of KBOO's holiday membership drive. It's a short drive. It will end on the 7th, starting on the 3rd and ending on the 7th. So visit kboo.fm to find out how you can help fund member-supported, volunteer-powered community radio. And also tune in next week or all week this week, and you can join by calling the station as well. Well, it's a collective labor that brings you The Old Mole every Monday morning at 9 a.m., and I want to thank all of our contributors and guests, Bill Resnick and Susan Palmeter from 350PDX, and Bill Resnick again with Lynn Adelman in a part one of a two-part interview. He's a federal judge in Wisconsin, and they're talking about the Roberts Court and the assault on democracy. Also, Larry Bolden, our book mole, and Joe Clement and Dennis Gravy. Thanks to Patricia Kohlberg, our engineer, and I'm Denise Morris, your host this morning. Have a great Monday.